Well, as I say, it's really great to be with you. Should have coming up on the screen, just for your delectation, a picture of Tyndale House. So you just see number one is the old house, number two is the library, three is the chapel we have, where the English Standard Version was translated. It's got a bit of housing towards the bottom as well. It's a great resource to be able to have, and do come and visit us sometime. It's not always as sunny. Let's think about this subject of the objection to the Bible. It's not fair. There are several objections which get repeated again and again. I think of them particularly as the subject that the Bible is violent. That's one question, particularly the Old Testament. One is the question of slavery. The Bible supports slavery. Some people say it's sexist or it's homophobic. And we're going to try and tackle all of those in one talk, which might be a bit mad, but there we are. Here we go. I want to start with what I see as the biggest objection that people come across, and that is they read the Bible and they read about God commanding wars. And they say, oh, look at what's going on in these wars. God commanding the Israelites to destroy the Canaanites. That's violent. It's also genocide, they would say. And this is how people might put the case against the Old Testament. God commands Israel to destroy nations, including non-combatants, including children. It's always immoral to kill innocent people. That's incompatible with God being a God of love. And isn't that just like lots of religious violence today that we condemn? So you can see how, right at this current time, when people are thinking about all sorts of terrorism and things like that, it's a big problem which gets thrown at us. So I want us to think about that. And I want us to think about it in the light of a particular, I don't know whether any of you play games, computer games, or prepared to admit it in such an august and Christian context. But what we have here is we have a game called Let Me Out. And this is a golden piece that needs to get out through this gate. But in order for the golden piece to get through, that grey piece needs to go up. But for that to go up, this grey piece needs to go across. But for that to go across, this grey piece needs to come down. So now, what our society often does is it asks us a question to which it only allows a one-move answer. It wants a soundbite answer. Now, I can no more give a soundbite answer to many questions than I can get that golden piece out in one move. It simply can't be done. And what a lot of the time is we have our society, the way people are thinking, has been wrongly programmed. People have all sorts of wrong ideas, and we need to move a few pieces round in order for things even to make sense. People are trying to put the last bit of the jigsaw in and saying it doesn't fit, when it's because they got so much of the rest of the jigsaw wrong already. So we actually need to take time to communicate with people about what we believe. And I want to start with one bit of the jigsaw. Now, this is one of the more complicated slides, but there we are. The mere fact, I want to explain, that someone commands or intends or undertakes the taking of innocent life does not mean that they are good, they're not good, nice, loving, or preferring to give life. Now, don't worry about the complexity of any of these slides. You can get them all afterwards, because I sent them on to the organizer of the conference, and they can find a way of getting them to you, and you don't need to come up with a pen drive afterwards. But they're free for your personal use. But I want to explain this, because a lot of people, when they think about, if I asked you the simple question, is it always wrong to take innocent life? I think most of you would say, yeah, right? But then I want you to think about the terrible incident that happened a few years ago with 9/11. You remember the attacks on the trade centers and so on. And around that time, there were four terrorist planes, but there were also two F-16s which were scrambled. And those F-16s were scrambled to try and intercept United Flights 93, which in fact was on a later schedule than the other ones, when people had already realized what was being used, what the terrorists were doing with these flights. They were using these flights as missiles. And they were told they needed to bring down that plane. Now, they didn't actually get to the plane in time, and it was brought down in other ways. But the interesting thing is, in those days of ill preparation for terrorism, the pilots didn't even have armed planes. And so Mark Sasfilm, the lead pilot, said to Heather Penny, the other pilot, I will take the tip of the plane, you take the tail. They were intending to ram the planes. We've got that on record. We know what they're intending to do. Now, what's really interesting is that when they came back to land, they weren't arrested. They were obeying executive orders. And although there was political controversy, no one criticized anyone in the entire chain of command for that order. No one did. Why? Because everyone knew that everyone in that whole nasty position had been only trying to save life. They'd been trying to make sure as few people were killed as possible. It's an extraordinary situation. But the mere fact that someone commands or intends to take innocent life, because most of the people on those planes were innocent, does not mean they're nasty. Now, why do I want to say that? I want to explain that because a lot of people will take just the superficial reading of the Bible, the superficial reading, and they say, well, God is commanding the taking of life, you know, including kids. Therefore, he must be nasty or bad. Well, are you going to apply that test to your F-16 pilots or to the Norwegian commandos who during the Second World War sunk the SS Hydro on one of the lakes in Norway when it was being used to transport heavy water, which the Nazis were going to use for a huge bomb? They didn't warn the locals that they were going to sink that. They were intending to give life. Now, I think those are really, really exceptional circumstances. I think the Old Testament circumstances is pretty exceptional. But I want just to lay that out in order to buy time. So I can just explain that there are other things I'm going to explain about that analogy. I wanted to also say, I've got 10 arguments relating to violence, but I sometimes do 20, but I'm probably just going to do 10 today. There's lots and lots of evidence of God's goodness in the Bible. And that's an absolutely key thing. As there was with these F-16 pilots, they woke up in the morning wanting to do a good job. They were professionals. They wanted to save life. And they were prepared to die to do so. So I've got loads more evidence of God's goodness. The best evidence I've got, I mean, is the cross. I mean, that's what I'm going to want to lead off on or get to very quickly. Lots and lots of evidence. Character reference we could go for as well. Another big thing, a difference between God and those pilots. You see, there's a moral vulnerability for those pilots. And the question is this: do they have the authority to do what they're undertaking? Okay, we might grant their intentions are good, but do they have the moral authority to take someone else's life? Does even a US president have the authority to command the taking of someone else's life in that situation? And you could debate this or debate that. What I want to say is, God is in a different situation. The US president doesn't own anyone's life. No one but God owns anyone else's life. And you know the reason you shouldn't take someone else's life? Very simple. It doesn't belong to you. The reason you shouldn't take your own life? Why not? It doesn't belong to you. You see, I want to define very carefully my terms. Some people talked about the sanctity of life. That's okay. But remember that shorthand. Because you are allowed to do things when you have due authorization. I could give you my car keys. Now, if you were to take my car without me giving you my car keys, that's theft. If I give you my car keys and say, could you move my car, it's not theft, you see? So if the right authorization, someone could give an authorization for someone to write a check, a finance officer in a business or something, if they were not to have that authorization, it would be embezzlement, you see? Now, this is it. God owns every life. The shorthand might be we say life is sacred, but I'd want to say more accurately according to Bible, it's this. It's the not belonging to you-ness of life. It all belongs to God. The not belonging to you-ness of life. We believe in the not belonging to us-ness of life. It belongs to God. Every single thing belongs to God. God's the giver of life, and so everything just comes from him. So I therefore want to define murder as the unauthorized taking of life. And there's only one being who can ultimately order the taking of life, the one owner. There's another vulnerability with our pilots as well. And that is that they didn't know, if they were going to ram one of these planes, that the goodies weren't about to get back control. Imagine if they had rammed the plane and it had been brought down. Maybe some of the relatives of the innocent victims on the plane would have said, well, how do we know the good guys want to get back control? And there would have been a debate. But God's not in that situation. You see, there's two moral vulnerabilities with those pilots. One is they don't own life. Two is they don't know the future. Well, neither of those exist with God. He owns life and he knows the future. Now, if we're prepared to accept that those two pilots were actually heroes and their careers have gone really well, you look at their careers after that, they've gone up through ranks and ranks, got lots of rewards, not just because of that what they did that day, but other things as well. Hasn't hindered their careers at all. If we're prepared to accept that those people are basically brave and good and nice and kind, I'm using these terms in relatively, you understand, why would we not accept exactly the same with God, who doesn't have those moral vulnerabilities? The other thing we need to do is, I'm going to argue today that the Bible is completely true historically. But for the sake of a moral objection to the Bible, I'm going to say, let's pretend it isn't. Let's just pretend it's a mere story. Well, guess what? Stories have rules. If I'm reading The Lord of the Rings, within that story, there are such things as hobbits. There's a ring of power. There's a guy called Sauron. If I'm reading Harry Potter, I'm in a world of magic. There's a guy called Voldemort and all sorts of other things. And when I'm reading that story, I enter into the rules of that story. You understand? Now, if you're an atheist, you don't believe in God, guess what? The biggest character in the whole Bible is God. I can no more read the Bible and factor him out than I can read Harry Potter without the character Harry in. Or The Lord of the Rings without the existence of hobbits. It is that ridiculous a style of reading. But that's the way a lot of people read the Bible. They read the Bible and they say, well, I don't believe that he exists, so I'm going to read the rest of the stuff. And then it becomes a secular story about how a bunch of Israelites went in and killed a load of Canaanites. You see, but guess what? That is not what the story is. So what they do is they launch, if you like, two missiles simultaneously. They say, one is the Bible isn't true. Secondly, it's not fair. Well, I want to say that's not fair. If you're objecting to the Bible, you've got to object to it as it is, not as you've made it up in your head. So I allowed my children to watch Tom and Jerry when they were younger, and they still can. And one of the reasons why is I believed my children were sufficiently discerning to recognize that different physical laws apply in the Tom and Jerry universe, and that sometimes, if they try this with each other, they may not have the same effect. You could think of other stories. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know, someone chops a broom in half and it becomes two brooms. One of the reasons why we think that stabbing someone is a bad idea, even in just secular terms, is that it tends to be painful for them and it tends to shorten their life. Now imagine if stabbing someone gave them intense pleasure and lengthened their life. Actually, you'd probably have different rules about stabbing people, wouldn't you? Now, when we're looking at the Bible, a secular person reads the story of God's command to Abraham to offer up Isaac. And they read it like this. He plunges the knife if he does it, and he's taking away the only thing Isaac has. The only thing Isaac has is his life. But that's not actually the way the story goes at all. The story goes like this. God has already promised to Abraham, he's shown himself to be trustworthy, he's promised that Abraham is going to have immense numbers of offspring through Isaac. Therefore, Abraham knows that whatever happens with that knife, if he plunges it, Isaac must have some future existence to generate the offspring, you see. So I don't need to read Hebrews to know, which says that he knew that God would be able to raise him from the dead. I can get that just from Genesis. So they read, and they actually misread the biblical story. These are miraculous narratives. So what happens is people tend to read these stories as if they can take the miracles out. And it makes a big difference. And that means that when we read these biblical narratives, you can't draw a parallel between them and modern terrorists. You know, these terrorists, they get these crazy ideas in their head and think they can go and do something. Now, in the story of the Bible, which I think is not just a story, but let's say it is just a story for the sake of the argument. In the story of the Bible, the number of people, men, who are there at the mountain when God gives the Ten Commandments is 603,550 men, the most carefully given number in the Bible, and everyone who's been reading the Bible for longer than a year should know that number, 603,550. It's so carefully given and so repeatedly given. Huge number are there, and they hear God's voice under the mountain. Now, most of us believe that William and Kate actually got married, right? Anyone doubt that? Good. The number of eyewitnesses to that event is actually quite small. Lots of people saw it on screen, but the number of people close enough to verify it, very small. So at one level, we think it's one of the most witnessed events in the whole of history. Yeah, you know, all of those people, the most watched wedding ever, really well-witnessed event. But actually, the giving of the Ten Commandments was a far better witnessed event. 603,550 men, plus the women and children, all there under the mountain. God's external evidence that he's speaking to Moses, huge. The greatest display of signs and wonders in the entire Old Testament is the time of the Exodus. The pillar of fire, the pillar of cloud. The idea that some of these commands were given in some unverifiable way. No, this is objective evidence. The same sort of objective evidence that makes you or me think that we're in Ebbsfleet, right? You know, we think we're in Ebbsfleet. We are in Ebbsfleet, actually. But what the sort of evidence? There's far more evidence within the story that God is speaking. This is objective evidence, not subjective, just going on inside your mind. So in other words, what I'm showing is you lots and lots of differences. Now, we could also say, we don't know that the Canaanite children were worse off dead. There's a question where Christians don't... I mean, the Bible doesn't tell us much about what happens to children. When they die, we know that there is a judgment. We know that God's fair. We know that everyone must decide, are they going to follow God or not? But the Bible doesn't tell us much about that. We simply don't know the situation there. But we do know that I've been talking about people being innocent, but the Canaanites are not innocent. They're actually wicked. They are sacrificing their own children. Again, the story tells us, and I think it's not just a mere story, they were sacrificing their own children. But that's an integral part of what went on. Also, they are warned and able to repent. Now, this is really key, and a lot of people don't notice this. As Joshua is going into the land, the first thing that happens is the camera slows down and we focus in on this one woman who's seeking after God. And she says to the two spies, I know that the Lord has given you the land and that the fear of you has fallen upon us and that the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we, i.e. the inhabitants of the land, have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond Jordan. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted. There was no spirit left in us because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now notice this. She's seen the same evidence as everyone else, and she's recognized who God is. That's witness number one, the water of the Red Sea. Witness number two, we look at Joshua 5. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan, not the waters of the Red Sea, the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. In other words, all of the people in the land knew that God had done not one, but two remarkable water miracles. And guess what? The king of Jericho said, shut the gate, we're going to fight. So in other words, they were warned. The people, the Gibeonites also say of how they've heard of God, and that's why they're coming to seek peace. So in other words, God, we read in the Bible, two or three witnesses, he gives these Canaanites two amazing miracles, and they decide to harden their hearts, but Rahab responds. And we might argue, and it's difficult to debate this, that there may have been no reasonable alternative. So the idea that you should kill off the adults and then leave the children, well, the children are going to hear of what happened to the adults and avenge them, and so on. Actually, when you start thinking, now, the Bible doesn't explain God's reasoning to us for many reasons. The principal one is that our minds are so small and his is so huge. So one of the questions whenever you have a why did God question is, we don't actually expect to understand why did God questions unless he's explained it to us. Because if I say that our minds are 0.0001 the size of God's, that is a massive overstatement, right? You can't put enough noughts on, you know, to understand. You know, we can't. So we don't know what calculations went on in God's mind. But this is it. Just as we're prepared to accept that those F-16 pilots were basically benevolent, i.e. they wanted people to live, there is absolutely no reason to read the story of the Bible, even if God were a fictional character, which he's not, and say this character must be a mean character who doesn't like giving life. The Bible reveals God as a God who always prefers giving life and does not want to take it. So what if this act, in fact, put an end to Canaanite child sacrifice? Over the centuries, fewer children would be killed this way. I think there's every reason to think that God works and everything that God is doing is for good. But then when people make an objection, I want to be them to be a bit more specific. Which objection are they making? There are really just four that you can make. One is you could argue it's immoral for God to command the destruction of the Canaanites. Now again, within the story, someone may not believe in God, but do you believe that in this story in which God made everyone, it's immoral for him to take put an end to someone's life? Are you going to make that argument? Because I don't see any logical grounds you can make that argument. You might say, oh no, but the Israelites should have disobeyed the command. Really? Or you might say, reading the Bible causes people to be violent. This is a hard objection to make because, after all, our society doesn't seem that much concerned about various videos and computer games and the link they may have with violence. And if you really want to make an empirical argument that the Bible is causing people to be violent, let's go and do our experiments with our control group of people who read the Bible and our control people who watch these videos, and let's see what happens. What I do know is that stories like what happened in Bella Vista prison in Colombia, one of the most violent prisons on earth, and people read the Bible and they became Christian and it was just transformed and no longer violent. I don't hear of people sitting in prison reading Richard Dawkins's The God Delusion and turning away from a life of crime. Have you ever heard those stories? You know, I just thought I must give it all up. It doesn't happen. So please don't try and make that one. But someone might try and say, you know, but actually the writing of these stories was changed the facts. Well, that's a historical objection, not a moral objection. So I don't think that any of these objections actually stand up. I want to move on now to the question of slavery. Here is atheist Sam Harris. In assessing the moral wisdom of the Bible, it's useful to consider moral questions that have been solved to everyone's satisfaction. Consider the question of slavery. The entire civilized world now agrees that slavery is an abomination. What moral instruction do we get from the God of Abraham on this subject? Consult the Bible and you'll discover that the creator of the universe clearly expects us to keep slaves. Now you can see a bit of weaseling language there at the end. But then he does a good move. He quotes the Bible. Now this is real Bible now. So you might disagree with the first bit, but how can you disagree with the next bit? And so then he quotes the best verses he could have quoted, the ones that seem to support his case the best, Leviticus 25. As your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are round about you. You may also buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and their families that are with you, who have been born in your land. And they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your brethren, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another with harshness. Notice that's from the Revised Standard Version. So we got some problems. We're talking about buying people. We're talking about slaves. We're talking about bequeathing them. We're talking about possession. Oh dear, does this mean the Bible is supporting slavery? You could see why someone might conclude that way. So we've got a problem, haven't we? This is the problem. Bible translations talk of slaves. In the Old Testament, no objection is made to having slaves. And in the New Testament, Christians who have slaves are not commanded to free their slaves. In fact, slaves are told to submit. Read the letters of Paul. Therefore, biblical texts approve of slavery. Fifthly, we know that slavery is wrong. Therefore, biblical texts approve of something that is wrong. Okay. Now find your way out of that. How many of you feel uncomfortable with that? Feel some force to that? Anyone? No one. One person, two. Okay, that's good. Several. Good. That's the thing we're going to try to solve. And we're going to solve it like this. Again. We're going to have to move around several pieces. I want to start with translation. This is important. Look at the word slave in different translations over time. In the King James Version, remember, 1611, wonderful version. Who here uses the King James Version? Great. God bless you. Wonderful version. One of the best translations ever made. King James Version, back in those days, there's only one occurrence in the New Testament and one in the Old of the word slave. When the New King James Version comes along, there are more. The NIV, there are more. There are more in the ESV. There are more in the NRSV. JPS, probably not a translation many of you know. It's called the Jewish Publication Society. Guess what? It's only got the Old Testament. Back in 1917, only three occurrences of the word slave. When they revised it in 1985, they had 135. Well, is that just English translations that happened? Well, no, it's not. It also happens with German translations. A very, very similar word, sklave and feminine sklavin. Back in the old Luther version, up until 1912, not a single occurrence. When they revised the Luther translation, 70. Oh, what happens in the Spanish translations? Well, you see the masculine word slave, the feminine word slave. Back in 1909, just four occurrences. Revise it in 1960, they get 25. Revise it in 1995, they get some more, 65. So you see this growth through the 20th century of the word slave in Bible translations. So that's one piece we need to move around. Just to recognize what's going on there, I think it's various social changes, changes in language, some of the social changes with the First and Second World Wars. People trying to look for an up-to-date word, they use the word slave. But let's think, is it the right word? Look at this picture here. This is a picture of ancient Hebrew, really ancient. And I want to tell you that that is the letter L. Okay, isn't that? It looks like the letter L. It is the letter L in ancient Hebrew. And so that's really cool. I know it looks different from the Hebrew you're used to. And this says, belonging to Shema. You can see the S, the sigma there, Greek on its side. The servant of Jeroboam. Now this guy is using the Hebrew word, which is getting translated slave. He's clearly a high up official with his own stamp. And he's jolly proud of the fact that he is the servant of Jeroboam. So just as the word minister means servant, but prime minister seems to be quite an important job, right? You know, first servant. Here we have the word which nowadays people are rendering slave, but it's a pretty high up person. Because this word doesn't really mean exactly the same as our English word slave. What it really means is it's translated both servant and slave, but it's not inherently negative. It's possibly never negative on its own. It really relates to work. Someone's subservient, and everyone's a servant of someone else. So Israelites are servants of the king is servant of God. So there's no non-servants around. So that's something you've got to recognize. There's a change in language. Now think about this. One of the most terrible things that Brits have been involved in was the North Atlantic slave trade. Remember how, you know, the British and the French used to travel the west of Africa, make people addicted to rum, get them to sell their compatriots, drag them over, work in conditions worse than animals, over to North America, South America as well. And terrible shame in our history. And when we hear the word slave, that's often what we think of. Or we might think of Roman slavery. Now remember this, when we're reading the Old Testament, none of that had happened. So in order to read the Old Testament the right way, we have to unlearn what we know. We have to factor out what we know. We need to think what's really going on. And in the Old Testament, it's pretty clear that the essence of what's going on in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is you've got people who are working as domestic servants, herdsmen, and so on. If Abraham dies without children, Eliezer is going to inherit everything. The children of Bilhah and Zilpah, who are servants, are going to inherit and be free. These people are trusted with valuables. Abraham sends his servant off with masses of wealth and 10 camels on a long journey. They're even given weapons. Now, one thing slave societies do not do is give the slaves weapons. They're given weapons to bring back Lot. And I think there's no approved selling of people. The only selling of people we get is Joseph's brothers, and that was a bad idea. So when we actually look what's going on, we compare slave systems over time. We find in the Old Testament, people are given enough holiday, they're given enough food, everyone has equal access to the city gate, which is where you do your legal stuff. There are the toughest laws you have on sexual protection. They cannot be kidnapped. That's a death penalty for kidnapping. They're never in chains. Tortured or physical abuse. If you so much as knock the tooth out of your servant, you have to let them go free from all future obligations. That's quite different from Roman slavery, quite different from New World slavery. What about runaways in the Bible? It says you shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place that he shall choose, within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. Well, wouldn't we like to be able to move to wherever suits us now? Compare that with what was going on in the southern US before the Civil War, where if you didn't give up a slave, 6 months in prison and a $1,000 fine when the dollar was worth rather a lot. But you might be troubled by these words, buying and selling. You're probably a little bit less troubled by the idea of buying and selling football players, though, aren't you? So just think about that. What we find is generally in the Bible, people are in the question of debt slavery. So you've got a subsistence society. They haven't got any extra money. They're told to be kind to each other and generous. But let's say you run out of all resources. The only thing you can do is pledge your future work. And that's what people did. Sell your future work. Get something now. Pledge your future work. Or they sold their daughters. Now, were they trying to cash in on their daughters? How many camels can I get for my daughter or whatever? No, not at all. They're actually doing it because every marriage involves two financial transactions. That is bride price and dowry. That is, the groom gives money to the bride's father, and the bride's father gives money to the new couple, which is kept in trust, such as if he cheats on her, she gets to keep it. Now, that provides a sort of financial security to a marriage. It's not, so we read it as buying and selling, but it's, you've got to realize there's always financial transaction going on there. So what's really happening is temporary leasing. Without salesmen or intermediaries, bodies retain their rights, and of course, God owns everything. So don't read it as secular slavery. But you still might not be happy with the Old Testament, and you know, that's okay. Because when our Lord was asked about divorce, he said this: because of the hardness of your heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. In other words, some of what we have in the law of Moses is permissive law or regulation, not saying this is good. If you like, it's like having laws on gambling. The people who wrote the laws on gambling, trying to restrict gambling, aren't saying gambling's good. They're just trying to put some limits on it, okay? The reason the laws in the Old Testament were not stricter is simply this. People were too sinful, you know? And law always has to have that balance between the ideal and compromising to people's sin. Because if you wanted to make everything that's wrong illegal, we would all be in prison. You know, make every thought, unkind thought that someone has, illegal. You know, I mean, you can't do that with law. So the law has to find some mid-place between stopping some wrong and not stopping all wrong, because guess what? That's what happens at the final judgment. So we read the Bible, and surely the same argument Jesus used applies to polygamy and to slavery, that in the beginning it wasn't like that, one person having multiple wives or one person having dominance over others. So that means we can read laws in the Old Testament that have allowance for that, not as saying this is okay, but as saying this is being regulated. But someone might say, but I'm not happy because the New Testament should get rid of slavery. I mean, don't the New Testament writers, Paul and so on, say slaves obey your masters? Well, think about this. Firstly, Christians couldn't change the system by voting. They didn't have any vote. If they said, slaves, you've got to rebel, well, those slaves would be executed. That's not very smart. But actually, it was illegal to free all your slaves. There was a law called the Lex Fufia Caninia. I know you woke up this morning thinking about it. But it's a law that goes like this. If I have 3 slaves, I can only free 2 of them. If I have 10 slaves, I can only free 5 of them. If I have 30 slaves, I can only free 10 of them. In other words, if Paul would say, masters, free your servants, slaves, they would not have all been legally free. It would have been discounted, not actually valid in Roman law. In fact, if you freed someone in Roman law too early, you could stop them ever becoming a citizen. So although Roman slavery is a complex thing, you know, we've got to think about it in light of that. But does that mean the New Testament endorses slavery? Well, think about this. In the New Testament, it teaches us to love others as Christ loved us. Well, that one thing surely abolishes slavery. But it also teaches that we're brothers and sisters. This is a huge thing. And then it has, on top of that idea that we're all one family, equals brothers and sisters, they have a kissing campaign. Now, this is really interesting. Not just in Paul's letters, but also in 1 Peter, you talk about the kiss. Holy kiss. Holy kiss. Very important. Now, people say, aha, that was the equivalent of the English handshake back then. They used to kiss each other. Now, tell me. No, really. Was it part of the culture back then that Jew would kiss Gentile? Was it part of the culture back then that slaves would kiss their masters? Give us a break. This was radical. Across those social boundaries, it was scandalous that you should kiss. Whom do you kiss? You kiss your family. By the way, if you want to have the holy kiss today in your church, that's fine. Maybe this new church you're going to start in Ebbsfleet. You've got to start by kissing the people you least want to kiss. Very important. But what you're saying is you're saying we are brothers and sisters, you see? And so it's a tangible action to push that family nature very, very strongly and say this beats all other allegiances. It beats rank, social rank, race, anything. It beats. This beats. This tie that you have to that person is huge. And then we have lots of instructions by Paul to masters to give people equality. And I don't think that's equality amongst their slaves. I think it's equality to themselves. Philemon is told to accept Onesimus no longer as a slave, but above a slave, a beloved brother. And then what is their watchword? What is the thing they sing all the time? It's simply this: Jesus is Lord. Lord means master. Lord Jesus Christ means master Jesus Christ. So they can't legally abolish Roman slavery, but they can say we are a new nation with its own national laws inside our nation. The nation, you know, because what you understand is, what's my nationality? My nationality is Christian. Okay, British secondarily. My primary nationality is Christian. And those are the laws that I need to live by. And in this, you know, this new nation which has been founded, brought together from every kindred, we are brothers and sisters, and Jesus is master. And you know, you have the option. You can be free from Christ and a slave of sin, or you can be free from sin and a slave of Christ. I know what I'd rather choose. Let's go on briefly to the subject of sexism. So at least I get to the third topic. The Bible, people say, is very sexist. Well, look at this. Over 3,000 named characters in the Bible, under 150 women. So that gives us about less than 5% of the named individuals in the Bible. Therefore, I would say it's futile to argue that the Bible treats men and women equally. You're always going to lose. The Bible is sexist. But what is equality? Well, many terrorists treat their victims equally. This is no joke. But that terrible incident in Nice, the man drives the truck along the boulevard there, treated people equally. Do you really want equality? Is that the sort of thing you want? Communists, they love equality. You know, this is Cuba. Everyone's equal. Do you want to move there? No. Equality. Or a neighbour of mine, Professor Stephen Hawking. This is secular equality for you. The human race is just a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet, orbiting around a very average star in the outer suburb of one of among 100 billion galaxies. We are so insignificant that I can't believe the whole world, universe exists for our benefit. It would be like saying that you would disappear if I closed my eyes. Chemical scum. Now, the great thing is we're all equally chemical scum. Is that what you care about? You can wake up in the morning and say, I don't mind being scum, provided I'm equal and no one else is like super scum. I mean, really, is that what we care about? Or think what happens in the secular country of China. Now, isn't it interesting? Here we have a country set up on the basis that there's no God. And they try and do their thing. And what happens? Well, who suffers here? Well, look at this. Now in China, we're at about 120 male births to every 100 female births. Guess what's happening? Well, it's the girls who are getting aborted. And you say, that's the way they do it out in commie China, isn't it? But at least we're more equal over here in Europe. Think about it. Trafficking in humans, modern slavery, 70% female. I wonder why. Is it because people want more women to do heavy weightlifting? Maybe not. Go to our most secular continent, namely Europe, and it's 80% female. Now, in the continent which most prides itself on giving equality to women, what's happening in this continent is, in fact, the women are suffering from this trade to feed the sex industry. 22% European women will say they've experienced non-partner violence since age 15. 5% of European women raped since age 15. And in the US, the porn industry is bigger than the live sports and live music industries put together. So this secularism promises liberation to women. It promises equality. It says, just come our way. We're the people who look after women. Really? It's a false promise. And what's the value of an old woman? Well, you see, the problem is this. Secular society tends to value people for what they contribute to society. What they can do. It's all about what you can do. So someone who can't do anything, what use are they? What use are the old, male or female? But what does the Bible say? The Bible says this, and this is really important. There is equality in the Bible. We are all in the image of God. Now, let's unpack that word, image. Image is a 3D picture, right? So we are all 3D pictures of God, which means if we lose anyone here, we've just lost a 3D picture of God. That's sad, isn't it? That means everyone is of infinite value because they are a unique 3D picture of God. No. Mustn't read too much into this. God is invisible, but God himself and his word has said, we are in his image, which means we reflect him. We see something about God in the people around us. So whereas Stephen Hawking will say chemical scum, the only value you have is the value that people assign to you, Christians respond and say, no, every person has infinite value. Tell me who values women more? The group who say women are chemical scum, or the group who say every woman has infinite value? I mean, isn't it fairly obvious? And then we see another thing going on in the Bible, and that is that women play a very interesting role. There's that sordid story, isn't there, in Genesis 38, where you remember how, various things happen with Judah's sons and they get killed, and the third one is due to be given to the first one's wife, Tamar, and she doesn't get given to him. She dresses herself up as a prostitute. Judah goes in unto her, and she becometh pregnant. And what happens is, he says, in his fair-minded way, let her be burnt, until she says, this staff and the signet, they're yours. Oh, okay, we just drop that subject, shall we? Now, why does the Bible give us that in Genesis 38? Very, very important story. Because that is the line that leads to David, and that is the line that leads to Jesus. We're very interested in family lines. So Onan, who spilt his seed on the ground, just lost an opportunity to be ancestor of the Messiah. But that's very important. And here we have Tamar, the Canaanite woman, whose initiative gets her to give the DNA to the Son of God. Remarkable. The storyline of the Bible changes on that woman's initiative. Or when that seed is being destroyed because Pharaoh is killing off all the male children. Who is it who rescues them? Oh, the two Hebrew midwives. Or the way Rahab changes sides at that key point and she gets into the messianic line. Or we look at how David, who has been rather too rampant in his sexual tastes, by the end of his life is basically impotent and seems to be senile. Who comes in to make sure Solomon's going to be king? It's Bathsheba. Another Sheba. Jehosheba makes sure that Joash is going to be king. She hides him when Athaliah is killing out others. Esther saves the Jews. And Mary's obedience to accept the calling again. Now, all of these are on the messianic line. Every single one of them. The whole of history leading to Jesus depends on a woman's initiative. So you want to tell me women don't do significant things? Look, who gets more mention? The guys. Who gets more mention in the Gospels? Well, it's the guys. Who do you think gets portrayed as playing a better role? The women or the men in the Gospels? It's the women, isn't it? So the men go around having their name in lights everywhere. And, you know, really important. You know, and they get their big kings and everything. But actually, when you look at what the Bible's doing, it's doing something a little bit more subtle. It's not trying to give us the boring secular narrative of we're just the same. Well, if we're just the sameness, I mean, how exciting is sameness? Not very exciting at all. The Bible says we're different, equally in the image of God and different, not trying to do the same things. And yes, the men may go around making more clamor, but you know, what better event could you witness in earth history than the resurrection of the Son of God? And the people who are there first are the women. So I want to say, very different roles, but it's really amazing the role that women do play and of paramount value. So I'll just end there. I think we've got a break.